Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm Christina Kuzmich, inviting you to join us for this hour of conversation with our guest, author Warren Adler. Warren Adler has written 24 novels since the time he published his first book in 1974. His novels have been translated into more than 24 languages, and two have become major motion pictures, the classic The War of the Roses, starring Michael Douglas, and Random Hearts, starring Harrison Ford. Warren Adler is perhaps the only novelist who has created a complete ebook library of his works, which are available on most ebook publishing venues. But writing wasn't the only career that Warren Adler pursued. For years, he was a successful businessman. He owned 4 radio stations and a TV station, and he ran his own advertising and public relations agency in Washington, D.C. But once he wrote that first book in 1974, he was hooked on writing and stuck to it ever since. His latest book is called Morning Glory, and that's morning with a U. Warren, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you, Christina. Happy to be here.
Tell us something about Morning Glory and how it came about.
Well, Morning Glory is a book about a woman who is down on her luck, on the cusp of 40, a very dysfunctional, divorced, single mother, terrible daughter, and loses her job in Palm Beach. And the woman that fires her, the manager of the store, says, why don't you go out and find yourself a rich man in Palm Beach? It's the richest county in the world. It's a community where there are only rich people walking around, rich guys. She says, how am I going to do that? And she tells her, why don't you haunt the funeral parlors and look for a rich widower who has had a happy marriage and unfortunately has lost his wife. And she does that and creates a whole persona that is different than what she really is. What she does is claim a greater education than she has. Her daughter is on her way to Princeton and all these wonderful things about herself. And she worms her way into the social life of this gentleman. And they are tripped up by the fact that she falls in love with this guy, and so does he. So it's kind of a bizarre love story, and that's basically, I'm not going to tell you any more, because I don't want to give away the plot. But it is a very interesting book, I think, I hope. It's my 24th published novel, and there's more to come. So that's the story of Morning Glory.
Now, Grace Serantino, who is the main character, she epitomizes a certain type of woman. She's bright, she's hardworking, but somehow she's destined to repeat that same mistake until life passes her by. Now, did you base her character on women that you know or have seen?
Well, I don't really base my characters on particular single entities. These are an amalgamation of many of the people that we've met in my lifetime. And there are a lot of women walking around like that, near 40, disappointed, still attractive, wondering how to better themselves. Now, I know it's probably not exactly what the women's movement would suggest a woman do in that position, to look for a man, a dependent, that somebody who she could be dependent upon. But when you're desperate, you take measures that are sometimes not politically correct. And this was a bold move on the part of Grace, and she took it in desperation. And it worked out for her. But I'm not suggesting that other women follow the same path, but when you're up against it, back against the wall, and you have to fare for yourself, you sometimes have to do things that are creative and resourceful, which is what my character Grace did.
And she did that, contrary to all the feminist thinking that is currently in vogue. When you created this plot and you created this character, you realized, of course, that this was going against the feminist trend of thinking. What has the reaction been on that issue?
It's gotten wonderful reviews, and there hasn't been that much of an anti-reaction. I mean, what would the feminists really say about this? Here's a woman that needs, that takes desperate measures, as I said before. So I don't think that you have to be politically correct. I happen to be a very strong feminist and believe in women's rights and that women should there should be no glass ceiling for women. But I have a feeling that there is a lot of compassion out there for women to women. So I don't believe that I will get any criticism on this book. I haven't so far, although I want people to be aware that it is not politically correct.
Mm-hmm. Now, in her search for that perfect rich widower, Grace concentrates only on Jewish men. And
because I happen to be Jewish, and there is kind of a mythological idea that Jewish husbands are better to their wives, and for some reason that I don't quite understand. And there's a lot of satire in this book, too. I mean, these books aren't, all of my books are bittersweet in many ways, and satirical, and humorous. Even The War of the Roses was satirical in many ways, had a lot of humor in it. And many of my books are written with tongue-in-cheek. So even though there is a great base of reality in my books and my characters, there is a bit of satire that just hangs in there just below the surface.
Grace has a daughter, Jackie, whom she named after Jackie Kennedy. And Jackie is the type of teenager that you would just love to hate. She steals from her mother, and she carries on this dirty little affair with a white supremacist. And how did you go about creating this character of Jackie?
Well, I don't, you know, I really can't find a lever in my brain that can give you a real answer. But I think that if people will look at certain programs that I don't look at, like the Jerry Springer Show and Jesse Raphael, that I see occasionally when I'm on a treadmill and shut off quickly, there's a lot of dysfunctional people on there, and maybe something filtered through on my very brief moments watching these things. There are a lot, and of course I know a lot about rebellious teenagers. One of my granddaughters is a rebellious teenager, but not in that category at all. Everyone that has a 16-year-old daughter can relate to this woman, even though this young girl, even though their children are not quite as bad as she is. But in the end, of course, the end of my book, she turns out to be a very loving child and makes up with a mother, so which is the fate of many teenagers that do stupid things until they hit a certain level of maturity and then change overnight.
You show a great understanding for women throughout this book, both in the characters of Grace and Jackie. You're able to get into their thought processes and describe exactly how they're feeling. How do you do that as an author?
I observe, I listen to women, and I like women. I'm attracted to them, even though I have a long-term marriage. If you listen carefully to women, you learn a lot about them. Of course, I've been trying to figure out women all my life, and this has helped me a great deal, writing all these books. Most of my books have very thorough, strong, interesting women characters, and I think that that's very important, especially since 80% of all the readers of novels in the United States and probably the world are women, believe it or not. So I try to attract women to my readership.
In Morning Glory, Grace tries to improve her life and her lifestyle by marrying this very rich and much older man. And she goes about it in that very morbid manner that she attends funerals to meet that perfect grieving widower.
Uh-huh.
How did you hit on the idea of funeral parlors or funerals?
Well, you know, if you live a long life, you've been to a lot of them. And a funeral is a kind of a gathering, whether you're Jewish or Irish or anything, the Irish wake, for example. This is a gathering of friends and family, and it's a way in which you conquer grief or at least help the grieving process, and you socialize. And in the many funerals that I've attended, socialization is part of the whole process. So I thought of it as a very good way where people meet each other, even for the first time, because they have something in common, the deceased. And in this case, Grace pretends to have something in common with the deceased, who was the wife of this man. and she volunteers to take care of the clothing, the disposal of the clothing, which is a traumatic experience for somebody who is living and has lost a spouse. And that's her modus operandi into getting into the social circle of the grieving man.
Let's take a break here and segue into some music. When we spoke earlier, you had mentioned that you have a fondness for the music from Camelot.
That's true.
Anything particular that you would like for us to hear? And what is it about Camelot that appeals to you?
Well, I like all the songs. I love musicals, Broadway musicals, and I like all the songs of Camelot. And for some reason, it speaks to me. Maybe because I lived in Washington during the Kennedy years, and that was called Camelot. And that was a wonderful time in our country. And I just feel that there's so much interest and hope in that play that it really socks it to me.
What do you want us to hear from Camelot?
If I were to leave you, how did that go? I can't
if
remember.
If ever I would leave
if
you.
If ever I would leave you. What a beautiful song. Oh, that's a fantastic song.
Coming up, If Ever I Would Leave You, from the Lerner and Lowe musical Camelot, and it's sung here by Robert Goulet.
If ever I would leave you, it wouldn't be in summer. Seeing you in summer, I never would go. Your hair streaked with sunlight, your lips red as flame, your face with a luster that puts gold to shame. But if I'd ever leave you, how could it be in autumn? How I'd leave in autumn, I never...
That was If Ever I Would Leave You, from the Lerner and Lowe musical Camelot. It was sung by Robert Goulet from the original cast recording that was made in 1960. And you're listening to Profiles. Our guest is author Warren Adler, author of 24 books. His latest book is called Morning Glory. Now, let's go back to the roots of your writing. Did you always want to be a writer, and how did you go about developing that talent?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer since I'm pre-teenager. And those who feel this calling, because that's what it is, it's a calling, will tell you how difficult it is to get published, especially if you have other obligations. Now, I had a young family, even though I wrote books when I was 16 years old. I could never get them published. But when I married very young, and I had three little boys, and I had to take care of them. So I continued to write, but I went into business, various entrepreneurial things that required writing. I had my own advertising agency, and I eventually bought a few radio stations. But I always wanted to be a novelist and short story writer. And I would get up early in the morning and I would write, then I would go to work. Of course, I was the boss, so I didn't have to check in. And what happened was, one day, a man comes into my office and says, "Do you promote books?" And I said, "Well, we're in the advertising and PR business. We do anything." And he said, "What would your fee be?" And Eureka! Like the balloon in the comic strips. I had this idea. I said to him, "If your publisher was a small publisher in Philadelphia, would publish my first novel, then I will do the work for nothing," which I did. And that's the way I got my first novel published, pure luck. And from then on, it's a little easier once you have your first novel published. And, of course, the rest is history. The movies discovered my books. I've sold 10 books to the movies. And from then on, when The War of the Roses came out, it established my reputation for writing this kind of a novel. Then came Random Hearts a couple of years, last year I think it was. And I had a wonderful adaptation of my short stories called The Sunset Gang on public television. And Lifetime Cable is doing the pilot of my mystery series. This will be shot in January. It's based on my 6 mystery books, where the character Fiona Fitzgerald is a Washington detective, daughter of a senator, handles only those cases of high-profile politicians and diplomats. And we're looking for a lead now, and I hope we'll have that very shortly and begin shooting January 23rd. And if they love the pilot, which I know they will, it will be a regular one-hour series on Lifetime Cable. So I'm very much in the ball game, still nibbling around the edges of Hollywood, and we hope it makes it.
What do you mean by nibbling around the edges of Hollywood?
Well, I'm not a big fan of Hollywood for writers. Writers are treated very shabbily in Hollywood, and this is notorious. Everyone knows that. I was there for 6 years and was on the Warner lot trying to get my movies made, and I found it's a very nerve-wracking industry. Everyone has their own agendas. Nobody is really natural. It's a tough, gritty business. I prefer to live in New York and not in Hollywood anymore. My wife hated it, although I did meet some very nice people there. This is not to mean, I don't intend to mean that everyone there is terrible, but the industry seems to be so insular, and everyone is so focused on their careers that it does not make for a really happy place. But so we got out of there and went to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where I still have a residence and a home, but I only go there summers now, or part of the year. And I prefer Manhattan, which is really the central point for anyone of for writers. It's a writer's town. It's got a lot of energy, and it's the place of my birth. So I really have come home, and I'm very happy here in Manhattan.
You're really a New York kid. You grew up in New York. You were
born
there.
I'm a New York kid. You got that right. Don't ask me what I was doing in Wyoming. But there's a lot of New York guys in California. As a matter of fact, I have a high school reunion of all the high schools in New York City at the Beverly Hills High School every year. And it jammed with New Yorkers who went to New York high schools, which I did, of course. And it's very interesting. But I still prefer Manhattan. This is the place to be. This is where the intellectual center of the United States is. And I have a very good life here that is intellectually satisfying.
Now, you didn't pursue that writing career in a consistent manner in your early years. And it wasn't really until, 1974 that you took up writing as a full-time profession. In between that time, you were a businessman, and as you said, you had you owned radio stations, you mm-hmm. owned a television station, and you were also in public relations in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that environment?
Actually, I specialized in political accounts and in real estate accounts. At the point that I was in business in Washington, it was thought to be a boomtown, and I named and promoted many of the properties in Washington, D.C., including Watergate, which I named, although people will never give me credit for that, because Watergate was the name of a restaurant that was in that area. And it was a logical extension, and that's the name we all chose. I was very involved in Washington. We lived there for 30 years, and my wife ran a magazine called The Dossier, which was like the town and country of Washington. It was like the house organ for the movers and shakers of the world. And she ran it for 15 years and was a White House correspondent. And I used to tag along on all these diplomatic parties and various other events at the White House and the Capitol. And I got a lot of material that way. And I recycled a lot of that material in my books. Which is one of the reasons Fiona Fitzgerald, my character, my mystery character, is part of the Washington police force. So you see where a lot of these things come from.
Fiona is part of the Washington police force. How much research do you have to do?
I did a lot of it because luckily I found a woman detective that was able to give me lots of material, walk me through the minefields of the Police Department of Washington, which is deeply involved with the movers and shakers of the Washington area. And Random Hearts, incidentally, is based upon a plane crash that happened in the Potomac a number of years ago. And I was lucky enough to get the reports from the police department of what had happened in that plane crash. It was an Air Florida crash, you may have remembered. Went right into the Potomac. And it provided me with lots of material. And that was originally going to be a detective book, but I write so fast I can't. I couldn't get more detective books published, so it became a mainstream novel, and of course Harrison Ford made a great movie of it. So there is another strange path you take in life.
Now, you say you write real fast. How do you write? Because some authors, for example, or some writers would prefer to write longhand because they need the time to think, and others do it on the word processor or on the computer. What's your style?
I, for years, used to write on a little Smith Corona electric typewriter. I used to have three of them, one in the shop, one ready in case one broke down. For the last 15 years, I've been writing on a word processor, on a computer, which has done it's wonders for a writer. If you make a mistake and want to change the name of a character, you can change it in seconds. I used to have to go give it to a secretary, and then make changes and go back and forth and back and forth. This is a real boon for writers. The technology available today for writers is fantastic. I try to write 5 pages a day and try to stop at the end of 5 pages so that I know where I'm going the next day.
I read somewhere that you're a 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. type writer.
Yes, I'm a morning person, but no longer 5. I sleep a little longer than 5. I get up at 6, and I'm addicted to the New York Times, which I like to read before I begin to write, and then I go to work, and I will write much past 10 because I don't have to go anywhere anymore to work or things like that. I just continue to write. I have a number of unpublished works that will be published. As time goes on, I have a new book called Cult that will be published under my indicia, my umbrella, through my resources on the Internet, and that will be coming out probably in March or April, although it will be available as an e-book earlier than that.
So you're bringing up a new topic here that I would really want to go into. You're a really serious proponent of the e-book development.
Well, yes, e-books and print-on-demand, which is a book that can be printed in 1 minute and sent out in the mail. So all of my books are available in every conceivable format, not only in e-books, but in trade and hardback, trade meaning paperback, where they can be printed in 1 minute in the trade paperback and overnight in a hardback, and available all over the world through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble, through FictionWise, and many, many sites that sell books on the Internet, on the web, and also in brick-and-mortar stores. And so I'm really pioneering a whole new approach for authors. I think I'm a little early, and I don't see anybody in my wake, any other authors, taking advantage of this fantastic opportunity, because you literally don't need a traditional publisher, although I have one. My publishers, I continue to publish the traditional way, but I'm experimenting on the other way of doing things, and eventually, in my view, the ebook and this technology will eventually, maybe not in my lifetime, supplant the paper book as we know it. And I could assure you that people are reading these ebooks on Palm Pilots and other PDAs, personal devices, and as more and more people become interested in these personal devices and they get more user-friendly, there will be more and more people that will be reading on screens. Now, most people will say, people of, let's say, over 30 or 40 will say, I won't give up my paper book and curl up on a chair or bed and read my book. Well, there's a lot of people reading books on screens in bed, not disturbing their spouses. And I know because I have a revenue flow from people who download my books. My website is warrenadler.com, incidentally. But all of my books, you could go to Amazon and look me up, or in Barnes & Noble, or in FictionWise, and you'll see all my books available there, all 24 of them.
What would you tell an aspiring writer who wanted to bypass the publishing house route and go to the e-book directly?
Well, one thing he can do, or he or she can do, is put the book out there in a databank that will have their words preserved forever. The big problem for an aspiring writer is promoting this book so that people become aware of it. This is the real problem. It's easy to do the technology. It's easy to get a book, a real live book, as an e-book or as print on demand, available. The trick is to get other people to want to buy it and download it through that source. Now, most of my activity, and now that all the infrastructure is completed in my websites and in everyone else's website, is to promote my books so that people are aware of my name. It's a branding process. My books will never go out of print. And there's one other angle to this. When you write a book, when you copyright a book, it is available, protected, 75 years beyond your lifetime. Now, I'm trying to create a branded authorial name that will go for 75 years beyond my lifetime and provide my children and children's children income and interest for many, many years. So, and people don't think of that because mostly a lot of these copyrighted books, they molder on shelves, and 99.9% of them are never heard from again. Well, I worked pretty hard on my books, and I wanted to see if they could still live on beyond my own life. And, of course, during. I'm not planning to go yet. So this is a whole different concept, and I speak all over the world on this subject. I just spoke in Frankfurt, Germany, at the book fair in Paris. I'm speaking before the Library of Congress, and I try to send this message to everyone that these things are coming, and authors should wake up to the fact that this provides a rare opportunity for them to at least project themselves into the publishing firmament, because the traditional publishers do not publish every piece of material that is given to them. In fact, they rarely read them. A lot of the material comes through agents, and getting an agent is difficult. It's a very competitive, difficult, frustrating business.
Why do you think that more authors are not taking this route?
Well, because there is a difference. I think art and commerce is separated in the mind of most authors. I am lucky because I enjoyed entrepreneurial life prior to my becoming a writer. So, I mean, a published writer. So I have a great deal of entrepreneurial experience, and that's exactly what I'm applying to my art. And most of the writers I know don't get it yet. Eventually they will. But I think I have to show them the way, or somebody has to show them the way. They should be taking advantage of this and not frustrating themselves by being rejected constantly by the major publishers. It's a very difficult business, almost like being an actor in Hollywood, which is 10 times worse.
I want to go back to your childhood or your early years in New York when you were a kid. Who were the authors that you emulated, the ones that...
Well, I'm a very traditional guy. Grew up in Brooklyn, New York. And my favorite authors in those days were Thomas Wolfe, Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, John O'Hara. These were the people that I looked up to in the period that I was growing up. And, of course, I have a lot more. I've widened my own tastes. There is a particular author that writes in French, although he's translated. Georges Simenon, long dead, wrote about 300 novels, every one of them a little jewel. He invented the detective Maigret, and he writes psychological novels. But I thought his work was good. I'm a great believer in compression. My books move very fast, so does his, and I make sure I am accessible to my readers. I watch that very carefully. Accessibility to me is the most important thing, otherwise you don't reach everyone. I try to make my prose not turgid and work very hard on clarity and making sure that everything moves with a certain pace and swiftness.
As you were going to school and learning how to write and learning how to write through reading, is there any teacher or mentor that you had who really had who had a profound effect on your style or your thinking?
Absolutely. My freshman English teacher at New York University, I was 17 years old. His name was Don Wolfe, and he was fabulous. And that was my mentor and inspiration. And when I graduated New York University, he had a course in the New School in New York. It's the New School, one of the great schools in New York City. And I took creative writing classes. He was just my professor of English. I took two creative writing classes with Professor Wolfe. And in that class was such people as William Styron, Mario Puzo, and on and on and on. And that was the breeding ground for some of the best writers in America. Some of them never published. Some did. Some never published for various reasons. But they were a terrific bunch. Yes, I had a mentor, and it was terrific. And, of course, the other writers that we would meet with each other around kitchen tables during the week. Mario Puzo and I was much younger than him, but we would meet every Friday and read our material to each other. To a group of people. It was very social and interesting, and it was a highlight of my lifetime.
Let's take a break here and listen to some more music from Camelot, chosen by our guest, Warren Adler. Warren Adler is the author of 24 books, which are available at local bookstores as well as in the ebook format. And his latest novel is called Morning Glory. Warren,
yes, dear.
What from Camelot would you like us to hear now?
Well, I like the signature song, the one that goes, a law was made a distant moon ago here.
And coming up next, we have Camelot, sung by Richard Burton.
It's true. It's true. The Crown has made it clear. The climate must be perfect all the year. A law was made a distant moon ago here. July and August cannot be too hot, and there's a legal limit to the snow here in Camelot. The winter is forbidden till December, and exits March the 2nd on the dot. By order, summer lingers through September in Camelot. Camelot, Camelot, I know it sounds a bit bizarre, but in Camelot, Camelot, that's how...
That was Camelot, sung by Richard Burton, from the Lerner and Lowe musical, and that comes from the original cast recording that was made in 1960. We're talking to Warren Adler. His latest book is titled Morning Glory, and we should emphasize that the word morning is spelt with a U. I'd like to talk about two of your books which were turned into blockbuster movies. There's that very successful The War of the Roses that starred Michael Douglas, and also Random Hearts, which starred Harrison Ford and Kristen Thomas. You were very happy about the way the War of the Roses turned out.
Yes,
but
I was.
You weren't so happy with Random Hearts.
That's
Can
right.
you tell us why?
Well, I see, Random Hearts is a story of forgiveness. And the director and Harrison just didn't get it from that viewpoint. And I had no influence on these guys. You know, they're like the apes. They make all the decisions. My story was like a suggestion to them, and they changed things that they should not have changed. It would have had greater impact if they had followed what I had done. Now, that may sound like sour grapes. It really isn't, because The War of the Roses, where I was not that influential, although I wrote the first screenplay, followed pretty much the design of my novel. And, of course, it's a worldwide classic. It plays somewhere in the world almost every day on television, and people quote lines to me wherever I travel in the world, including Asia. So the impact of that movie has been enormous, and the book is taught in many colleges and high schools because it deals with the ultimate dysfunctional divorce. Random Hearts could have followed that road, although a lot of people love that movie. It didn't do that well domestically, but it is doing very well in Europe, in its afterlife, in television, and in tapes and DVDs. So who knows? It may have the same life. I am very pleased with The War of the Roses. I mean, how could you not be? It's just a classic now. They did a fabulous job. It's helped the title of my book. For an author, the title of the book to be the title of the movie is a bonanza, because nobody promotes better than the movie business. I mean, that those titles are burned into the public mind. And even though I'm not too happy with the movie itself, Random Hearts, that doesn't matter. My unhappiness has nothing to do with it. The fact is that it is part of the ether today, and that's the. And of course, Harrison Ford is such an enormous star that this is one of the movies that will continue to live on as long as Harrison is a major star.
Your latest book, Morning Glory, has been cited as being ideal material for a movie. It has all the right stuff that movies are made of. It has this posh setting, colorful characters, and a controversial plot, and all this insight into human nature, both sad and amusing. And it has cosmetics in it, and it has designer clothing. When you were writing Morning Glory, did you also think of it immediately as a movie?
No, I never think of it as a movie. I'm always baffled when they buy my books. I don't even think in those terms. I'm sure that Morning Glory will find its way on the silver screen. But the problem is 10 of my books have been sold to the movies or optioned, and they've only made these two in the adaptation. And, of course, the mystery series is now happening. Eventually, they'll all get made. But I'm not too anxious to put them out as Hollywood features at this moment, because I want to have a little more input than I've had at Random Hearts. It taught me that you have to be there to at least guide these guys, because they once they buy it, they think that it's theirs, and they forget about the original creator. And I am now going to be a little more interested in sitting around the table, at least at the beginning of conception, because movies are a collegial experience. It's a collaboration of very strong-minded people, and you know, in the case of Random Hearts, Harrison Ford was the ape. He's the guy that made all the major decisions with the director, Sidney Pollack. They all have reputations, and they all have egos. So the next book I sell to the movies, I want to at least have the proper seat at the table and hope they will listen to me, and we will see.
This proper seat at the table, is that something that gets written into the contract as you sign it?
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. I mean, because it really doesn't matter. The writer, especially the original creator, unless he has complete control, casting and the director. He really has nothing to say, because those are the two items that make a lot of sense. John Irving had that in the movie he did. I can't remember the title.
Wasn't it Cider House
Yes,
Rules?
He had total control. He had director control, and he had writer control. He wrote the script, and he had actor control. And he was there at the table at all times. But that was a low-budget movie, and I think they did a magnificent job. I love that movie. But he's one of the few authors that I know has had the kind of control where his vision went on the screen. And in the writing of his script, he did take away a lot of material. You have to boil it down for Hollywood, and he did it himself, which is terrific. I would like that opportunity, but so far I haven't got it. Haven't had it. Doesn't matter what's in the contract. Unless you have that kind of control, you're out of the picture.
I want to touch on the teaching aspect of your career. You spent half of your year at Jackson Hole, in your home in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and you're the founder of the Jackson Hole Writers Conference.
That's correct.
Can you tell us about this conference and what it tries to achieve?
Well, it tries to help many wannabe writers, and we try to get some of the important writers in the country to come and address them. And there is a staff of people that help writers and read their material. And it's been very successful. It's gone on for 8-9 years, I think, at this point. I always give the welcoming address, and it's always very fulfilling for the people that come there. I would highly recommend people to come into that setting, because it's beautiful. Our mountain town is just gorgeous. And these people really want to be serious writers that attend, and everyone is quite serious about it, although we have lots of fun. It took me a while to get it going, but now it's taken off and is all by itself, and it's doing wonderful.
I'd like to touch a little bit on your family life, but more in the context of your writing. A common theme in your books is marital strife and misunderstanding. Yet your own marriage is one that has lasted for what, for over 40 years?
50.
Over 50 years. What's your secret?
I don't know what my secret is. I have the most fabulous, beautiful wife I chose when she was a teenager. And like two idiots, we got married too darn young. But we stuck together because I think that we respect each other's space. My wife is an only child, and she's not needy for company all the time. And although we're kind of joined at the hip, we very rarely have been separated. And to marry a writer requires space. And I've gotten all the space I need to write my books. And being an only child, she's able to amuse herself when I'm working. And she worked, she had her job, and we're pals. I'm an observer of human nature. I don't have to live it to write about it. So I have a fabulous marriage. I have no complaints. I'm 50% of the population that's still married, 50% of the married population.
Well, someone has to fill that statistic. You also mentioned that you have children and grandchildren. Did any of them go into writing?
Absolutely not. They're all talented in their own ways, but they're not writers. They're not even readers. But they are loving kids, and we're very happy with them. But it doesn't necessarily follow that your progeny take your talents. As a matter of fact, it's probably the opposite. They will rebel against what the father has done and do their own thing, which is what my kids have done. I have an actor, brilliant actor in Hollywood. That is, it's a tough deal. But he's out there, and while he hasn't become a star, he's very happy doing his business.
Morning Glory is now on the bookshelves and in several ebook formats. And it's selling to very good reviews. You're working on a new novel now.
I have a new novel coming out under my publishing umbrella, called Cult. It's based on my experiences in researching the cult phenomenon. So this is a story of brainwashing and a death cult. It's called Cult. It's about a man trying to rescue his wife from a cult.
And when will that be coming out?
That'll be coming out in April, and it'll also be available as an ebook on all the various e-tailing venues, probably in January.
You have no intention of retiring, do you?
Retiring? What's that? I mean, that's a concept that's been foisted on people. Why would anyone want to retire? To what? What are you going to do with the rest of your life? I mean, if you're a creative person, you want to continue to do what you're doing. And I'll retire when I retire from life. But I have no interest in putting down the shovel and the pick. I'm going to continue until it's over. It's over when it's over.
That was Warren Adler, author of 24 books, including The War of the Roses and Random Hearts. His latest book is called Morning Glory, and it's published by the Kensington Publishing Corporation, and it can be accessed at www.warrenadler.com. Warren, thanks for taking the time to chat with us.
My pleasure.
And we'll go out with music from Camelot again, especially...
Nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. Especially selected for this program by our guest, author Warren Adler. I'm Christina Kuzmich, and thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in December of 2001. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash. Luann Johnson, research assistant. For WFIU, thanks for listening.